it did not record. Here we go. All right, once again, we're here at the Hannon House with Sandra Turner Henney. She is going to discuss her life, her oral history, here in Detroit. And for the record, I'm Leon Bates, and this is December 7th, 2017, here in the city of Detroit. And the numbers are going across, so it's working. Tell me about you. Tell me about yourself as we get into this. We were talking earlier, and you said you are from Detroit, so you're born in Detroit?
Born and raised in the city of Detroit. I've never lived anywhere else. Wow. Been here. I'm 60 years old now, so 60 years of my life has been spent right here.
What part of Detroit? Detroit's a pretty spread out city.
It varies. I was born on the west side at Herman Kiefer Hospital. We lived on the east side of Detroit, right across from Belle Isle. Belle Isle was my playground.
Okay.
Yes. We moved west. Moving west in the city of Detroit was like a move up.
Really?
To move west. Because those were areas that we were not previously allowed in, you know.
Was
the west side of Detroit, basically. You know, we had our Black Bottom area. We had our area where the Fisher Freeway came through and destroyed the Black community that was a thriving community. We moved towards 12th Street. 12th Street was the new Black Economic District. Okay, we were over in what is now called New Center area.
New Center, okay.
Okay, so I stayed on 12th Street in Pingree and 12th Street in Collingwood and 12th Street in Calvert, and, you know, I saw the riots.
Okay.
I lived through the riots in the city of Detroit. In fact, I was four blocks from where it started.
Okay.
10 years old. Amazing to see places that I had the freedom as a 10-year-old to go to alone with no fear, such as the restaurants up on 12th Street, the candy store, mm-hmm. the ice cream shop, you know, and as back in the 60s, we could travel like that, and we didn't have to have a group of people with us, and we didn't have to have somebody, because everybody knew everybody, you know, so we were always looked after. And so it was amazing for me to see how quickly all of that could be destroyed, you know, and the fact that here we are 50 years later, and none of it has been rebuilt. You know, so I always think of it as we call it the rebellion, and yeah, we were rebelling, but I always think of it as a design process to end the economic aspect of the Black community, because that was we had everything. We didn't have to go out of community, you know. Mm-hmm. We had all our needs were within a walking distance, you know. A lot of us didn't have cars, you know. We would go downtown, but that was a venture, because if we really needed something, we got it right in our own community.
Okay. Were your parents from Detroit, or did they come from the outside to Detroit, or?
My parents are second generation Detroiters.
Oh, okay.
Their grandparents came from down south.
Okay, so your parents were born and raised in Detroit.
My parents were born and raised in the city of Detroit.
Wow, okay. All right. When you were growing up, and you said you were born on the east side and moved to the west side, you went to the Detroit public schools?
Yes.
Okay.
All the way through school, I went to Detroit public school. Excellent, excellent academic setting and education, and but then I was a child that loved school, so.
I understand. thinking back on the schools, was anyone who made a difference, either a school teacher or maybe even someone in the neighborhood that you think really made a positive effect or change on you, your outlook on school? Maybe a teacher, principal, a neighbor?
It wasn't so much an individual. It was school itself. Okay. School was exciting. I was learning something new every day. We were engaged. School was just such a positive experience for me. And I can remember in the second grade, I had Miss Daly on. She was my second grade teacher. And I can remember having a blizzard. We had a blizzard.
Okay.
They shut down the schools. I cried to my mother because it was no way Miss DeLeon was not going to be at that school to teach me. I knew she was going to be there. My mom bundled me up. I lived 2 blocks from the school, 2 little short blocks. My mom bundled me up, said, go. Go to school. That door was locked. I cried all the way home because I just knew that the teacher had to be there. Because, I mean, she was teaching me. She could not be there, you know, but the schools were closed. My first lesson learned.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. So as you are going through school and you get to high school, you've gotten past the 67 riots outburst. And you start looking towards your future as, you know, now you're going to out of school and moving into the adult world and into Detroit. What are some of your recollections about how that part of your life was coming together?
It wasn't. My teenage years were really turbulent years due to different family situations going on. However, what my career, or what I thought I wanted my career to be.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to be a psychologist because I felt like that would be the area where I could help people that were going through traumatic situations.
Okay.
You know, so that shaped my career field.
Okay. So that wanted to be in psychology, is that what eventually brought you to Wayne State and to study psychology there?
Yes. After starting a family, I went to Wayne Community College for a number of years. Didn't go into psychology to start with because it was about getting a job, making some money, and computers were coming of age.
Yes.
So I actually went into computers and the old IBM punch cards and learning all the different languages of the computer, Fortran and BASIC and RPG 1 and 2, and completely out of my area. I mean, I was just completely in the wrong field after having always been an honor student all the way through school. To get into college and actually get E's was devastating to me. I said, okay, this is not for me. Let me go. I know I like people. Let me go into the field I always wanted to go into. And after graduating from WC3, I went over to Wayne State I only had a year and a half to go. And so I majored in psychology and finished there.
Okay. And WC3 would be?
Oh, Wayne County Community College, which is now Wayne County Community College District.
Okay, all right. And then you went on into Wayne State, you got your degree there.
Yeah.
And then did you ever actually start working in psychology or?
No. Nope.
Okay.
I've always worked. I've held a job since I was 14 years old.
Okay.
Went into corporate America. And the thing about psychology is that it teaches you how to interact with people.
Okay.
You know, so it didn't matter what field, where I worked at, mm-hmm. I could always use my knowledge around psychology and my work. I went into banking, and I worked for some of the major banks in the city, and then I went into insurance and worked in home and auto insurance for over 10 years, and then I started really getting into working around people in the city of Detroit, you know, in the nonprofit sectors.
Okay. So you worked in several office environments, and you studied psychology, and at some point you've transferred that into the public sector and started to work, I understand, with politicians, and that eventually just led you into environmental activism.
Yes. Worked at the health department for a while under a grant, helping uninsured and underinsured residents in the city of Detroit get health care, which has kind of led me to really working with people. And after coming off of that job, I was offered a position to work with a state legislator. And of course, my field in working with him was around seniors and education and healthcare, because those were the areas that I had some knowledge in. That legislator went from the House of Representatives over to the State Senate. I became the chief of staff. And as I stated before, we got a call one day from a friend of theirs that worked for the fire department that said something was going on in the community, and they really needed a state legislator to come and see what was going on. It wasn't a part of our district, but because a friend had asked, we did it. Did let the state rep for that district know that we were coming into their district. I went to the district, got out of my car, and literally was hit by this wall of odor. It was 90 degrees outside, and it was like all of a sudden I was just consumed by the smell, and my head started hurting immediately. I got nauseated, and it was like I was just sick. I was just sick, and it was just hanging in the air.
What part of town was this?
I was over on John R. in Nevada, right where the east side, where the west side becomes the east side, right going north towards 8 Mile, down Woodward.
Okay, so north
of
downtown.
Yes, and low-income community of color. And they had a wastewater treatment plant at the end of a block, dead end street. And this private company was designed to take wastewater from different factories, and their job was to clean out the heavy toxins and metals out of the water and then dispose of it. Well, they were just dumping it down in the sewer system in the community, meaning that it was coming up in the basement of people's homes, so the smell was in their house, it was coming up in the streets. We had children 1 and 2 years old in that area that were on breathing machines, because this had been going on for a long time. This was just the first time someone actually said, we're going to do something about this, we're going to bring some attention to it. So we worked with that community for a year and a half. We were able to shut down the facility. MDEQ, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, finally shut them down. And this is a plant that had been fined repeatedly. They paid the fine and kept on doing what they were doing.
So they had a history.
They had a history. Because MDEQ is not... It's not enforcement. It's part of their job is enforcement, but it's not a part of their job that they've ever really done. They will fine you, but the enforcement part they weren't doing. So this place had a wall of fines. You know, they would pay the fine and continue to operate as usual. So we were able to bring a lot of media attention to what was going on in the community. We were able to actually get monetary compensation for the community. Not scientifically tested, that community had a lot of birth abnormalities mm-hmm. in births in that area. As I said, it wasn't scientifically proven, but we were able to get monetary compensation for the residents, get the facility shut down, and eventually torn down. So that was my entry into the environmental field. It was intriguing, and I found out this is happening all over the city, not just here. There's other areas of the city that are experiencing the same environmental injustice, you know, and I never knew it. I never knew that when I grew up across the street from Belle Isle, mm-hmm. that the Uniroyal plant sat there, and that all these toxins were going into the soil, and the same soil I was playing in, and that it was an environmental hazard. I didn't know this. Of course, now I know that the Uniroyal site where I used to play as a kid is one of the most heavily polluted brownfields in the city. You know, it's a Superfund site. That's how bad it is. You know, but I didn't know it, but now I know. I know where a lot of these environmentally hazard industries are located, and they're located in low-income communities of color.
So as you got into this, you stayed with environmental issues. What kept you interested or pulled you in and kept you involved in the environment as opposed to moving on to something else or even going back to psychology and dealing with people?
My granddaughter and my son attended Golightly Educational Center, a school where they had a lottery to get in, or you had to know someone. Well, of course, I knew a state senator, so I was able to get my son and my granddaughter into the school.
Where is it located?
It's located on Ferry, right at I-75 and Ferry Street, which is right on at the I-75, I-94 intersection.
So it's just east of here?
Just east of here.
Okay.
And right across the freeway from the solid waste incinerator.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to attend that school. My granddaughter, both my of them were healthy kids. My granddaughter the school was K through 8 at the time. My granddaughter was a eighth grader. Developed asthma. Never been sick in her life. Developed asthma to the point where she had to go on an inhaler. Many trips to the emergency room. Never knew what was causing it. Granddaughter graduated, went to a school further away in the city, and now she's 25 and has not used inhaler since then.
So the problem went away.
The problem went away, which led me to believe that the problem was the area in which she was in, because then it was environmental. I began to realize that a lot of the children in that area were suffering from respiratory problems. A lot of the seniors in that area were suffering from respiratory problems. But it seemed that if they moved out of that area, they disappeared. So it was something environmentally wrong going on in that area. And of course, we wind up connecting it to the incinerator, but not only the incinerator. You know, we also connected it to the fact that we are at the most traveled freeway intersection, you know, in the whole state of Michigan. The I-94, I-75 intersection mm-hmm. is the most widely traveled intersection.
Okay.
You know, so we not only have the emissions from the cars, but we have the emissions from garbage being burned, from the incineration of solid waste materials. And with no sorting. So if you're burning plastic bags and all of that, and they have oil on them, and you have all of this pollution coming out. So didn't know it at the time, as I said, but I kind of started figuring it out. And then wind up actually working in the environmental field around environmental justice issues. And Incinerator was the very first issue that I worked on.
Okay.
You know, and knowing the history that I had of my with my granddaughter, you know, it was really something that I could really dig into and wanted to dig into, because I wanted to find out how can we help this community and help these kids. Because when I was working for the state senator, I actually was able to help raise funds for a playscape for that school, because my kids went there, you know. And we built the playscape. The playscape was actually built on the side of the school where the freeway and incinerator sit. So we were putting the kids in direct harm,
right?
You know, and so I really began to look at the at different things surrounding the school and the fact that the incinerator was there and the freeway was there, and you know. So I began to work with a group called a new business model for Detroit,
okay,
which later became Zero Waste Detroit. And what we did was we designed a recycling program or a recycling pilot for the city of Detroit. Of course, we had to advocate for the program because the city, a major city, but we didn't have recycling. We didn't have curbside recycling in the city. So from 2008 up until 2011, we advocated for curbside recycling.
So curbside recycling, that's where the homeowner is actually separating recyclable materials from
garbage. Yes.
And it's collected separately.
It's collected separately, but the city decided to do a pilot program.
Okay.
So they did one community on the east side and one community on the west side. And they were using different storage containers, disposal containers. One side had the big Corvilles that looked like a trash can, and one had small bins. So they piloted the recycling program for about 3 years. Long pilot. Before they moved into full implementation throughout the city of curbside recycling.
So they did implement?
They did implement curbside recycling. And during that time, the incinerator itself went through three different ownerships.
So the incinerator is not owned by the city?
No. The city sold the incinerator in about 1990 because the city could not afford to do the upkeep to install the scrubbers that were required by the EPA. So the city sold it, but at the time the city still owed the bond debt on it because it had sold bonds in order to build the incinerator. So the bond debt was not over with until 2009 when we paid it off. But during that time, residents in the city of Detroit were paying $171 per ton of solid waste that was being incinerated. And the incinerator operators and company were receiving solid waste from suburban communities at $25 a ton. So Detroit residents were actually supplementing the suburban's incineration of their trash.
So the trash is being processed, being collected and incinerated from the Detroit residents in the city of Detroit proper. And it's also being collected and processed from those surrounding communities that are not a part of Detroit.
Correct. At a much lower cost.
That's interesting.
Very interesting. And that's a part of the whole environmental injustice landscape. You know, we're actually paying to supplement the environmental aspect of burning trash and polluting the air, and we're paying for it. We're supplementing other people's garbage, you know. So that was a big thing, and we wind up getting the city to really move towards citywide curbside recycling with a stipulation that you had to purchase your cart. You had to pay $25 for a recycling cart.
Okay.
Well, that's a problem in a predominantly city of color that has been through bankruptcy, that has no jobs, you know, has a high unemployment rate, has a low educational skill level. Many families living below the poverty line. So $25 that can go on your heating bill or your food bill definitely was not going towards a recycling cart, which is way down on the priority list when you're trying to take care of a family. So Zero Waste Detroit, we were able to secure a grant working with the city in order to get free carts. If residents really wanted to recycle and were willing to do an educational sitting around recycling, the do's and don'ts of recycling, that they would receive a free cart.
Okay.
So we've been doing that for about 3 years now, and we now have 45,000 residents in the city of Detroit recycling, which is enormous increase in the last 2 years. You know, we went from maybe 5,000 residents starting to now 45,000. You know, and that's all through, and that's with education. You know, we've made it easier for residents to be able to receive cards. We now have an online system that can go online, take a quiz, and get a free card, a quiz that does the education.
So this is still ongoing. You're still giving still passing out cards.
Yes.
For folks who want to participate.
Yes.
Okay.
We paid off the debt. So now the city, whereas at one time we were beholden to sending all of our solid waste to the incinerator, now we don't have required tonnage. We can send as little as possible. And my thought is always, you know, get everybody to recycle, and we're going to do this so well that we have very little to send to the incinerator. And that will help the environment.
Right.
That will help us with better our air quality in the city. And, well, that's not true. And the reason why that's not true is because however less we send, they pick up more from surrounding communities. They make it up with surrounding communities' solid waste. So if we send 20%, they're going to get 80% from elsewhere.
So the amount that's being incinerated has stayed fairly constant. It's just now they're getting more of it
from outside of the city. Correct.
Interesting.
So when I tell residents about the great thing with recycling, and it is great, because we're doing our part, but the fact that it's really not decreasing the toxicity of our air in the city, because they're making up for it somewhere else. The incinerator itself, which is deemed a renewable energy because it generates steam. As you know, it's a 3-mile radius that is on the steam loop, what we call the steam loop. If you drive through the city of Detroit and you see steam coming up out of the streets, that's the steam loop. And you know, it's only in this area, the 3-mile area around downtown Detroit. That's the inefficiency of the steam loop because it's leaking because we got steam coming out. Well, what it does is it generates steam, which helps to generate electricity for DTE.
Okay.
And it heats 141 buildings within the surrounding area. A lot of the buildings are looking at sustainability now, and they're beginning to come off of the system, the steam loop. Wayne State itself is down to just one building on the steam loop, and it was a major, and they're down to one building. I found that out today. So it's a yay. So the fact that it heats the surrounding areas has always been a problem of, if we stop incinerating, how will we provide this energy that's needed? Well, at one point, the incinerator was going through some contractual issues, and they had to use natural gas, which is not the greatest thing either, but they used natural gas, and they were able to provide the steam without burning solid waste. And it worked. So we know that it can be done. But one of the biggest issues around the incinerator is the fact that it has always been a nuisance for residents in the area, because it's always been an odor problem. Okay. And the odor problem has arisen not from the burning of the solid waste, but from allowing the garbage to sit on the floors for a absorbent amount of time. And in the summer, you get these odors that hang in the air. So the incinerator, probably since inception, has continuously received fines from MDEQ. Again, not an enforcer, but they will fine them. The city, when the new owners came on board about three, four years ago, Detroit Renewable Power, they actually applied for a brownfield tax credit of $4.1 million. City Council awarded it to them. They had to go to Lansing for final approval. So a group of us went up and we gave testimony, and I told them the story about my granddaughter and other kids that I knew had went to the school with the same problems. And they took they granted them the $4.1 million, but they put it in escrow. And they could only get it once they cleaned up their violations. Well, they'd never cleaned up their violations. So, and that was 2011.
So the money's still sitting there?
No. Just found out a couple of months ago that money's been released. A couple of months ago, I found out the money, and I've always bragged about the fact that they have this money sitting in escrow. Well, they got the money. But it was supposed to sit there until they cleaned up the violations. But all in all, we have had some great victories around the incinerator. One, we got curbside recycling throughout the city. Two, we have gotten MDEQ through an engagement process that we designed with residents around the incinerator. We have them to call MDEQ 24/7. Whenever they smell anything, they make a call to the hotline. MDEQ will send out an investigator, and they will find them immediately. Well, after so many fines and it wasn't anything being done, and we were, you know, constantly meeting with MDQ, we were able to get the attorney general, the state's attorney general, to file a consent judgment against them. So now, anytime they get a violation, they have to pay $4,500 per day of the violation. See, now you're hitting people in the economic area and you're going to get some results. Well, part of that result is they actually just sold the facility to a company out of London.
Out of London.
Mm-hmm. Someone said Germany today, but the final sale has not went through. But I think it's out of London. So they sold the facility in July. Paperwork is still going on. This new entity will have to adhere to the consent judgment. But the one thing I have to say is that the odor problem is a problem, because it does hamper respiratory, it triggers respiratory illnesses in a lot of the people. But the thing is, it's the toxins that you can't see or smell that are more detrimental to residents. February 2017-16, they were out of compliance for 60 days for sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and particulate matter 2.0. And if anybody knows anything about particulate matter, it is so fine and minute that you can't, of course you can't see it, but it attaches, you breathe it and it attaches to your lungs and it clogs up your whole lungs. And so it is really deadly, you know. So right now we're fighting to get MDEQ and the Attorney General to file suit against them around this non-compliance for that period of time, and to find them, they want to find them as one incident because it was continuous. We want them to be fined per day. Okay, so that's what we're trying to get done at this point. So the incinerator has always been, you know, a part of the work that I've done in the last 10 years. You know, the incinerator sits again in a low to moderate income community. You know, you have housing projects over there, and you know, housing projects are normally subsidized for low income families. You know, and the idea is that is, this facility would never be in Bloomfield Hills. It would never be in Grosse Pointe. And mind you, we get Grosse Pointe's garbage. It comes to the facility. Mm-hmm. But you would never have this in your community. We're down to paying $25 a ton now, but Grosse Pointe pays $14. So we're still supplementing.
Grosse Pointe pays $14?
Yes.
And Detroit pays how much?
$25. So we're still supplementing for the fact that we allow other people to pollute our area. We're helping to pay for it. And I always say so it's a challenge. It's a challenge, but it's one that I'm willing to keep on fighting. And the fact, the one thing that amazes me with our city government as we continue to repopulate this city, The influx of capital in the city has been in the downtown and midtown area, where Wayne State sits. All an influx of a whole new population is now settled in this area. But the incinerator is right up the street. And many of those residents did not know that in the summer, you can't raise your window. Okay? They did not know that you may not want to take a walk outside on those nice days, those hot days, because you may get something you don't want to smell. You know? And now they're beginning to realize, so we really got a new groundswell of support, because these people are coming from the suburbs, moving back into the city. Right. They're not going to stand for it. You know, you got a whole new population that's paying taxes in the city, you know, and they're not going to stand for it. So we have a whole new group of supporters that we can now lean on as we continue this fight.
How have the elected officials, and I'm thinking more of the federal and state officials, congressmen, senators, state senators, over the long haul, how much of an asset or help have they been in the effort to try to change and improve environmental issues in Detroit, especially in the inner city Detroit?
Not very helpful. We had one state rep that represented Southwest Detroit, which is the third most heavily polluted zip code, 48217, in the whole country. The whole country. Not just Detroit, not just the state of Michigan, but the whole country. It is a community surrounded by, at minimum, 13 polluting facilities, including Marathon Oil, U.S. Steel, Zug Island, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, which has incinerators. Yes. So the representative for that community, which at one time that was our area, I can't think of her name off the bat, but the representative for that area fought long and hard for the 6 years that she was in the state legislature around environmental issues in the city of Detroit. State level, that was our, the biggest support was from whoever was representing that particular zip code, but with no concentrated effort to clean up the city environmentally. It was never there. We have a city council now that is somewhat, well, actually, our city council prior, our old city council where we had the Joanne Watsons and the Kwame Kenyattas, the activists, the great activists of old on the council, where they were establishing some policies and processes by creating the Green Task Force and creating the Environmental Justice Task Force to look at these issues for residents in the city of Detroit. Well, they're gone. And we don't have a lot of those activists anymore that's really standing up. We have the councilwoman out of Southwest Detroit, Constanato Lopez. She really stands up a lot around environmental issues. But Rashida Tlaib, that is the representative that was a state representative around 4217 in Southwest Detroit, is really an active voice. She's no longer in office, but she's still an active voice around the environmental injustice going on. But state government has been more of a grassroots effort to influence decision makers and influence policy.
What about representatives of color? Black politicians, have they been active in the struggle or?
No.
Okay.
And I say that because we have a black, we have a, our Detroit delegation was 95% of color. Always have been.
Why do you think they're not as involved or aware as possibly they should be?
Most of, because for some of them, it's not an issue in their community. And for those that have communities like where the incinerator sit, or have Southwest Detroit where you have all these polluting facilities, or have Jefferson, you know, where you got some of the factories of old, and, well, you got the contamination they left, you know. But if it's not in their communities, they're working for whatever their constituency advocates for, that's what they're working towards. So they're not concerned about Marathon Oil sitting down in Southwest Detroit because it has no impact on their area. And I think that's why I don't think that a loud enough voice is being raised that environmental injustices affects this vulnerable community. And if it can happen in this community, it can happen in your community. And I don't think that that is raised enough.
That's fair. What do you think should be done? What type of voice?
Oh, sorry, I forgot you guys are here.
Oh!
So what kind of voice or input do you think that you need to try and create, or not create, but to change or improve this situation?
I think that as we elect officials, to local, state, and federal government, that they must be fully educated around the issues that are truly impacting the health and safety of residents. They have to be educated. We have to not continue to elect people that are making decisions for us that are not looking out for our welfare. If you have a representative representing the area where the incinerator sit, they should have the biggest voice if they're in federal government with the EPA saying, look, we got to look at this term renewable energy. This is not renewable energy. You know, state level, this is not renewable energy. We cannot grandfather these facilities in that are polluting, you know, our communities. Or they have the biggest voice saying, look, we need renewable energy. We need to shut down DTE coal plants. We need to move towards solar energy or wind energy. You know, we need to start having a vision of beyond where we are now because we know it's not healthy. So as voters, we have to really start grooming candidates to carry that message, that we have to have a healthy, safe, and clean city, especially if we want to repopulate it. People are not going to move into a city where they have high rates of asthma and high rates of lead, and you know what I'm saying? Who wants to raise their kids in that environment? You know, you have young people moving in, but you don't have a whole lot of folks with families moving in.
Right.
You know, and the families that are here are families that's been here their whole life. You know, and either they have a love for the city or they can't afford to move. Those are the two scenarios.
Okay.
I love the city. I can afford to move, but I love the city. I'm not going anywhere. I'd rather try to change where I am than move.
Okay.
You know, and that's what it is. We have to start grooming people to carry the message that we want a city that is clean, safe, and healthy to raise families.
You raised lead a minute ago, which made me think about Flint, Michigan, which most everyone in the country now has been talking about Flint and their lead pipes and water crisis. That is an issue that many older cities face or may face. Has that issue become a problem in Detroit with lead pipes, or has Detroit...
The issue of lead in Detroit has always been an issue. Detroit is the number one city in the state that has the most elevated lead blood levels of children than any other city in the state of Michigan. And you're going to find these elevated lead levels in most of our urban cities because the housing stock is older. Detroit does not have a lead problem when it comes to water. We have the best water system in the world in the city of Detroit. We go to our taps and we drink straight out the tap. We're good on the water. But it's our housing stock and the fact that we are a post-industrial city and a city that continues to have a lot of industry that we have lead in our soil, you know. And we have an older housing stock that's never been abated for lead, you know, after 1978 when they got rid of lead-based paint, you know. And we're finding that we have a lot of generational homes where it was the grandparents' house and now it's the grandchild's house and she's raising kids. And then we're finding that for each generation we've had a lead affected child in that household. You know, because the house has never been abated for lead. You know, and we're finding that through a lot of the zip codes in the city, if it's not new housing, they've never been abated. So we still have a high concentration level of children that are being affected by lead in these homes. And it's an issue that we work on continuously. Because everybody thought, before Flint, for some reason, everybody thought, ooh, lead is no longer happening. Well, while they were thinking this, we were steady saying to the state of Michigan, look, lead is an issue. We need for funding to continue around lead abatement and lead risk assessments and this and that. And we had to keep fighting for it because people didn't think lead was an issue. Flint happened, and now everybody sees lead is an issue, but they only see it in water. Well, no. In Detroit, in Flint, in Saginaw, in Grand Rapids, our urban cities, you know, with older housing stock, this is an issue. And it continues to be an issue. And a lot of people don't understand how much we as residents in the state of Michigan pay for this lead, these lead cases. A study was done many years ago about prisoners in our state's correction system. Okay. Come to find out, a lot of them tested positive for lead. Because lead is it harms a child developmentally. If you are a child and you're going to school and you're not keeping up, you become a behavior problem. They're kicking you out. You know, they're putting you in special ed. They're doing this. They're doing that. Well, when you get to a certain age, you just stop. You just stop going. Okay, if you stop going to school and you never go to college, you never get a job, how are you going to take care of yourself? What do you resort to in order to survive? You resort to crime. You know, you wind up in our prison system. So now we're paying $10,000 to $15,000 a year to take care of you as a prisoner. And the fact that our prison system is overcrowded, we're paying for a whole lot of folks. Mm-hmm. You know, and for the fact that so many of them tested positive for lead, just showed a correlation between lead and our justice system and those that are incarcerated in our state. And so people don't understand the lasting effects of lead. You know, and how much it truly impacts a child. It never leaves you. Once you have lead in your system, it's there for the rest of your life. So you see, I get excited when you talk about lead because people is to me it's like the hidden environmental hazard, and people don't think it happens. And it Flint all of a sudden opened up all these eyes, but they only see water.
Right.
They only see water. The number of kids of children that were impacted in Flint by the Flint water crisis. It's nothing compared to the number of kids that tested positive in the city of Detroit for lead. And people don't understand that because they think, got rid of lead-based paint. That's over with. Well, no, the housing stock has never been abated.
Right.
It is still lead still in there. These houses.
It's still there. Let me ask you a closing type of thought or question. As we talked about air pollution and water pollution and now even lead pollution, if looking back on it, what would you say is probably, I know you said you had some positive impact on the incinerator and how that was being done and the private sewage plant that was finally closed and demolished. What would you say is probably one of the biggest challenges that remains that you haven't gotten over or you're still fighting? It seems like this is one that just, this is the problem that just won't go away. It's just the problem from hell that you just cannot seem to bring under control.
It would have to be incineration.
Even with the progress on incineration, that's still the one.
Because it's still going on. And as I said, yeah, we made progress. We're changing the way people think about solid waste. But anytime we're not reducing the amount of waste that's going to an incinerator. If we're reducing it in Detroit, they're picking it up elsewhere. And it is the the victory comes in being able to change the mindset of everyone around the fact that we cannot incinerate solid waste and not pay a health price for it. And the fact that that price is being paid by residents who have no choice. That's the biggest thing for me. And if I could go to places like Grosse Pointe in Oakland County, where we get most of our solid waste from, you know, if I can go to places like that and convince them, can you please stop sending your garbage to my city? You know, you're affecting my kids. You know, you're impacting their health. You know, if I can go somewhere and convince these people that they are a part of the problem and not the solution, it would be great. Okay, but that's not happening. That's not happening. So we will continue the fight to hit them as hard as we can economically.
Okay.
In the hopes that somebody sooner they're going to say, this is not a profitable business, and walk away from it.
Okay. Okay. I think that's probably what I need to complete this part of the interview. We could probably go on forever.
You see my passion.
The questions keep rising in my head, and you're very passionate about what we're talking about. Is there anything you think we didn't talk about that you want to mention before we wrap this up?
The one thing I want to say is that living in the city of Detroit, and we have been through a lot of struggles economically, environmentally, socially, we are struggling. But we now have this great opportunity to begin from the bottom up. We're at ground zero. This is the time to get it right. You know, environmentally, economically, we need to start putting into practice things that are going to make this a clean, healthy, and safe city. Businesses moving in need to move in with an idea that we are a clean business. You know, this is not the place to come to dump. You know. So that's my parting thought, that as we begin to transform, recreate, redevelop this city, let's do it in a way that is sustainable and clean for everybody. Okay. All right.
All right. I thank you. I will get this typed up and get it turned in.
All right.
And thank you for doing it.
You're welcome.